dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman whose intelligence we have had the privilege of tapping from time to time, and will do so momentarily, is Jessica Vaughn. She is the Director of Policy Studies for an organization I consider to be simply indispensable, the Center for Immigration Studies. She has served as a foreign service officer in the United States government in places like Belgium, Trinidad, and Tobago. And she has been a great resource, not only to this program, but to Congress and other media outlets for quite some time, specifically on matters involving immigration policy and associated issues, and always a welcome guest. Jessica Vaughn, thanks for coming on. Good to talk with you. So there are two topics that are on my mind that we've discussed in the past, and I'm sort of looking for an update from you on, Jessica. One is this practice of issuing driver's licenses to illegal immigrants. It seems as though this opens the door to all kinds of abuses, perhaps even voting abuses and fraud, but certainly others that can confer on individuals, you know, privileges or even rights that they're not entitled to. And yet this is sort of the coming thing in a lot of state legislatures. The Trump administration is pushing back a bit. Tell us what's going on this front as you see it.
That's right. This is a problem with state laws like this proliferating. The driver's license is really the key to the kingdom to living here as if you're here illegally, or to creating a new identity for yourself if you're a criminal or someone, a terrorist, for whatever reason you want to hide in plain sight. And that's what every state has found who has passed a law offering driver's licenses to illegal aliens. Every time, what they find is that despite their claims that it would make everyone safer, the opposite is what happens. And these states become a magnet for fraudulent applicants from out of state. They become a magnet for illegal settlement and a magnet for crime. And they provide illegal aliens with the documents that they need to no longer be undocumented. They can get a job, they can get social services, and they can conceal their identity if they want to, as the 9/11 hijackers did. We have to remember that those 19 participants in that attack on our country had among them something like 36 driver's licenses. And after 9/11, most states fixed their laws so that illegal aliens could not get them and tightened the standards to make these documents more secure. But now, because these certain political leaders in states that embrace open borders can't accomplish their goals through the U.S. Congress, they're trying to give sort of a de facto amnesty light by giving illegal aliens driver's licenses. But it compromises everyone's security. And New York has even gone one farther than any other state, and not only issuing driver's licenses to people who are here illegally or who bring in unverifiable breeder documents, they have in the process decided that no DHS agency, not ICE, not the Border Patrol, not Customs and Border Protection, can access the motor vehicle information in the state's databases. And they want to protect the illegal aliens who do get licenses by denying DHS access to this information. But in the process, they're denying the Border Patrol and ICE and other agencies the ability to verify the identities or learn something about criminal aliens that they're investigating, or even do the most routine checks of people coming into our country over land borders. So it's a huge problem and a real security vulnerability for all of us, not just New Yorkers.
The Trump administration, I gather, has been retaliating against this practice by denying all New Yorkers the opportunity to register for the Global Entry Program and some of the other trusted traveler initiatives of the United States federal government. How is that playing out? I gather that's being challenged in court as we speak, Jessica Vaughn, but is this an appropriate response as you see it? And do you think it might create the leverage on a state like New York to back down?
It is an appropriate response. And honestly, Frank, I wouldn't call it retaliation. I would call it a predictable consequence of New York's action, because under the federal law that created the Trusted Traveler programs, and these are programs where people voluntarily undergo more intrusive vetting of their background so that they can have expedited processing when they come in from out of the country, you know, like a quick line, an express lane through customs when you arrive in this country. So we have to know really who they are beyond what their driver's license or their passport says to be accepted into that program. The law says that DHS has to check people for motor vehicle violations like drunk driving or other things that would lead us to believe that this is not someone who should be given an express lane to get into our country. And so when they can't access the New York motor vehicle databases, they can't do those checks. So DHS simply said, well, I guess no New Yorkers are going to be able to participate in this program because we can't check out who they are. So I actually think that DHS is, you know, kind of keeping some of its powder dry. Now, predictably, New York has said they're going to sue. I'm sure that this will be cast as some kind of, you know, racist, xenophobic temper tantrum of the president. It's nothing of the kind. But, you know, I say bring on the lawsuit, because I can't see New York having a leg to stand on in federal court about what, you know, federal law requires and what is needed for federal law enforcement agencies to do the job mandated by Congress. And it should be a warning shot to any other state contemplating this kind of foolishness.
Well, let's hope so. We've seen federal courts doing a lot of crazy things, especially in this immigration law space. How does the real ID requirement factor into this, if at all, Jessica? We're now being advised, if you want to be in a trusted traveler program like TSA Pre, for example, by October, you're going to have a real ID certified driver's license from your state. Will these illegal aliens be able to get those as well, do you think?
Well, let's hope not. But, you know, without states cracking down on identity theft and, you know, when sanctuary jurisdictions look the other way at these things, I think it does have the potential to compromise our entire identification system. And what it also does is it forces Americans to have to do more to establish their identity. So everyone's going to have to get either a passport or an enhanced or real ID compliant driver's license if they want to get on a plane, walk into a federal building, leave the country. And that's not the way it should be. We should be cracking down on people who can't prove their identity, who are not citizens, who are coming here illegally, not make Americans go through more hoops to prove who they are.
It makes eminent sense to me. I have to say, I guess somewhat sarcastically, that it's okay because they'll be able to vote without any of those things, which is simply crazy. So much more to talk with you about. Jessica, thank you for your time today, as well as the great work you do at the Center for Immigration Studies. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about the threats of the Chinese in our capital markets, as well as with their coronavirus and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, the man we have the privilege of visiting with each week, our duty expert on matters involving America's interests in Asia and threats thereto, notably from communist China. Gordon is, of course, the author of three terrific books touching on these matters: The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. Gordon is also widely published in other places, including Fox News and, of course, The Daily Beast and National Interest. You can follow him on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang, and I commend that to you. Gordon, Good to have you back. Welcome. A lot to talk about, Gordon. I wanted to start, I think, with the fact that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivered yet another stemwinder about what a problem communist China is before the National Governors Association on Saturday. Particularly resonant with me was the comment that he made that the influence operations that the Chinese Communist Party is running against states and their governors, of course, but their state legislatures, their state public pension funds, very much tracks with some of the things that we've been warning about at the Committee on the Present Danger China, specifically that very malevolent Chinese companies are now being underwritten by our capital markets. What'd you make of the speech and the important message it conveyed?
The Chinese have, from the very beginning of our relationships, after reestablishing diplomatic ties, have been going after municipalities and going after states, especially with this sister city program. And the Chinese have been raiding states and municipalities to see which are the most friendly for Chinese investment. So clearly, they're going after not only the federal government, but also all levels of government. And also with, you know, with regard to investment of public funds, this is something which is absolutely critical. As we've talked about before, we cannot be funding those entities which are seeking to harm the United States. If we step back just a little bit, Secretary Pompeo's speech is one which he, in a series that he talked about in October when he gave his Hudson Institute talk, he said that there would be a series of speeches on China policy, and this is one of them. And we got to remember, Frank, that this looks sort of like what George Kennan did in 1946 and 1947 with the Long Telegram and with the X article. These really are setting out a new paradigm for America's relations with a rival. And I'm very glad that the Secretary of State has been doing this.
I am too, and not just here at home, but around the world too, notably in connection with the 5G controversy that we've been talking about for some time, Gordon Chang. Let me ask you about a related subject. He warned about the extent to which Confucius Institutes and Chinese students, for that matter, are being used as instruments of, well, perhaps at best, influence operations and at worst, espionage. Gordon, tell a little bit, if you would, about the Thousand Talents initiative that China has engaged in and what we've recently been discovering about how it's operating, notably at Harvard University.
Yeah, at Harvard University, we've had a senior professor in charge of a department actually was investigated and indeed has been arrested. What China with the Thousand Talents program is trying to do is to secretly buy information from American professors and scientists, and they've been extremely successful at it. The FBI says it has about 1,000 investigations, active open investigations of U.S. Of espionage in commercial secrets and technological secrets that China has been operating. So, you know, we've got to understand the breadth of Beijing's effort to take U.S. technology. And this really goes into what we've been talking about before, that each year China steals hundreds of billions of dollars of U.S. IP. On the Confucius Institutes, the U.S. has been successful in getting universities to close them down. But I got to note that the City University of New York has just signed a multi-year Confucius Institute deal with China. And so this is going in the wrong direction of opening up a new CI in the U.S.
And Gordon, I know you feel strongly about this. The extent to which these institutes wind up not simply being places where students on campus are taught Mandarin and otherwise encouraged to learn about China, but are really vehicles for exercising control over the curricula and the professors and visiting speakers and so much more. It really is an instrument of totalitarian control being extended here, is it not?
Yeah. What is happening here is that you have university administrators and professors self-censor themselves because they know that they're receiving substantial funds from China through the Confucius Institutes. And so this changes the whole atmosphere on campuses. And in some places, it's actually become quite coercive. So this, it goes to the core of academic freedom. It goes to the core of free speech on campus. And there have been real problems at a number of places where the Chinese students and the Chinese government and security agencies have been able to affect discourse in very bad ways, Frank.
We need to encourage more of these to be closed down, and NYU's activities very sharply challenged, it seems to me. Gordon, when we were talking about the companies that are involved in our capital markets, two that were particularly, I think, problematic and therefore alluded to, not by name, but in terms of what they do, I just wanted to visit with you briefly about them. One is Hikvision, which has been implicated by the U.S. government and sanctioned for its involvement with the surveillance state activities of communist China, the so-called social credit system and oppression of the faith communities, notably Uyghurs in concentration camps. The other is a company known as by its acronym AVIC, that is actually engaged in building weapons with which to attack Americans. There is now an impending decision to have not just companies like these in the portfolios of state public pension funds, but also to put them in the retirement funds of the federal retirement system, the so-called Thrift Savings Plan. Would you have any words of advice to the people managing that program as to the advisability of taking this action?
Yeah, it makes no sense that American companies can't contract with these Chinese entities because of the Commerce Department's entity list. But at the same time, they can make big investments in them. And indeed, the federal government, through its pension funds, can support these companies with, you know, billions of dollars. This is just nuts, Frank. So, you know, what we need to do is to cut all of those links. Roger Robinson and other people you work with have been in the forefront of this. And, you know, this is just so important for us to realize how many elements in the U.S. financial community have just been bought by China. This needs to end. And I think the president has to do it with a decision that there shall be no more federal investment into Chinese companies that harm us. And indeed, maybe no more portfolio investments into China, full stop.
Well, at a minimum, it seems to me that we have to make sure that these Chinese companies are not getting a sweetheart deal whereby they're able to operate in our capital markets, get billions and billions of dollars out of them without having the same disclosure requirements and transparency and accountability requirements that their U.S. counterparts require. This is a bare minimum, and I think was very strongly endorsed by the poll of likely voters that John McLaughlin did for the Committee on the Present Danger of China last week, Gordon. So we'll be continuing to redouble our efforts on that, especially with Mike Pompeo's seeming strong support. Let me ask you about one other thing that's obviously on a lot of people's minds at the moment, Gordon, just to get your sort of update on how you see things both within China and for countries like ours that are now at some risk of having the coronavirus, the so-called novel coronavirus, migrate from China to our shores. We talked last about, you know, the lengths the Chinese are going to sort of disinform and conceal and punish the whistleblowers about this virus. What's your current reading on their management of it and the actual trajectory of this lethal disease?
Yeah. Right now, we don't know, and that's because China has taken excessive control of the production of statistics, both of the number of infections and deaths. We have anecdotal evidence that suggests that the official numbers from Beijing really have been falsified. We're going to know a little bit more, especially this week, because China goes back to work after the Lunar New Year break, and we're going to see what the Chinese authorities actually do and whether that's consistent with their sunny narrative of what's occurring. So at this point, in about 2 or 3 days, we'll have a much better idea. But many virologists are coming up with numbers that are far in excess of what Beijing has been officially releasing.
And in terms of the extent to which this is now posing a pandemic threat to other nations, including ours, do you have a thought on that?
I don't know if this really meets the technical definition of a pandemic, which is really epidemics on two separate continents. But of course, this has spread around the world. And perhaps in Africa, this could become a pandemic, given what was occurring. In the U.S., the number of cases has remained relatively stable. And that's thanks to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And so we're doing a good job in terms of monitoring and controlling the spread. But not every country has CDC that is nearly as effective as ours. So that's the reason why we've got to be concerned going forward about other places. And it's great that the Trump administration has allocated $100 million for control efforts, not only here, but elsewhere.
Including some in China, of course. I guess Africa is a particular concern because there are now so many Chinese nationals there as part of the Belt and Road Initiative and the sort of colonization that they've been doing on the continent. We'll be watching this space closely, as I know will you, Gordon Chang. Thank you very much for your time today. Again, folks, follow him at Gordon G. Chang and also at Fox News and National Interest and, of course, here. Gordon, stay well, my friend. We look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, we'll pursue some of these topics with Jim Fennell, the former U.S. Chief of Naval Intelligence in the Pacific Fleet, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by a distinguished former naval person, as Winston Churchill used to say about himself. His name is Captain Jim Fennell, United States Navy retired. He served for some 30 years in various capacities, primarily in the naval intelligence space, but with a specialization in Indo-Asia-Pacific security affairs. He finished up his tour of duty as the Assistant Chief of Staff on the 7th Fleet Command with the responsibility for trying to keep those vital U.S. forces apprised of the evolving threat from the Chinese Navy and other military capabilities, and for that matter, its unrestricted warfare activities as well. James Fennell is a founding member, I'm very pleased to say, of the Committee on the Present Danger of China, and an extraordinary resource for all of us. Always a delight to catch up with him. Jim, thank you so much for finding a few minutes of time to give us an update. Good to have you with us. Well, Jim, you have been warning for some time, I think even before you left the Navy, about what you forecast would be a decade of concern. It seems to me we're pretty much in that decade now, thanks to the kinds of trends that you were seeing, namely the declining capability of the United States Navy, for a variety of reasons, especially relative to the increasing capabilities of the Chinese Navy, most especially given the geographic advantages that it has in the Western Pacific. Would you just give us kind of a quick net assessment of how you see us as we enter this decade of concern vis-a-vis the Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy and more generally?
Well, Frank, this notion, this thesis of the decade of concern, which I actually came up with over 8 years ago when I was still in uniform, is based on the thesis that by sometime between 2020 and 2030, that the Chinese are going to basically walk themselves into this notion that they're going to have to use military force to restore all the territory that they believe is theirs. They would prefer not to do it, as you said, and you mentioned fight. You know, they would prefer to win without fighting. But as those non-kinetic forms of manipulation are increasingly unsuccessful over the course of this next decade, the PRC has prepared themselves militarily to be able to use military force. And so the last 20 years, especially, has been Chinese military buildup. It's exemplified by the year 2019. Let's just use 1 year. When the Chinese produced in naval tonnage and naval ships, 23 major warfare ships, major combatants, compared to just 9 for the United States Navy. That's more than 2 to 1. And we don't know how many submarines they produced. So the U.S. number of 9 includes a submarine or two. So in terms of the last 4 or 5, 6 years, China's been outproducing the United States 4 or 5 to 1 for every ship that we build to every ship that they build. And the ships that they build have anti-ship cruise missiles and the ability to sink our ships from a longer range than we have. We have invested over the years in aircraft carriers, and that's the strength of our system. And the Chinese have built a missile defense system, or not a defense, a missile attack system to go after our aircraft carriers, essentially from anywhere west of Guam towards the Chinese mainland. They have the DF-26 and the DF-21 that are specifically built to target our aircraft carriers. And they have hundreds, if not thousands, of these missiles. They have the satellite intelligence infrastructure to be able to track, we believe, our carriers fairly well. And so those missiles will be able to find our carriers anywhere in that first and second island chain of the Western Pacific, the Ryukyu Island chain and the Bonin Island chain. And this capability is only increased over time. And as this next decade goes along, and as economic influence and information warfare influence and diplomatic influence wanes with China, the People's Liberation Army are going to be increasingly asserting that, hey, if we want to restore our territory and be able to achieve our great China dream and the great rejuvenation by 2049, then we're going to have to use military force sometime before 2030. Otherwise, the world will never, you know, recognize and celebrate our great achievement at 2049. So that's the risk right now, is that they convince themselves, or they're convincing themselves, that they're more and more capable. And we just saw here over Sunday and Monday, now it's been reported, it's happened 2 days in a row, that you've got PLA Air Force bombers, fighters, airborne early warning aircraft, frigates, destroyers, all circumnavigating, in some sense, the island of Taiwan. And it was reported that even for the first time that I'm aware of, that Chinese bombers have actually crossed the center line, which is a unofficial line, but it's essentially the center of the Taiwan Strait. And for years, Chinese and Taiwan air forces would not cross that line. It was kind of an unofficial recognition that, hey, we don't want to escalate tension, so we won't cross. And so we've had a crossing of fighters we hadn't had for almost 20 years in this last year, a few months ago, and now we have these reports of bombers coming across.
So, Jim, you're again, an accomplished student of what the Chinese military is capable of, as well as a practitioner of the art of naval warfare. I heard an interview you gave to the Epoch Times the other day in which you talked about the trends, as I said earlier, now manifesting a qualitative as well as quantitative edge for the Chinese Navy relative to our own, and that they are quite possibly reaching the point where, as you've indicated, they're prepared to put it to the test. I think you said that would still be dependent on whether they think they can get, through coercive means, unrestricted warfare of the non-kinetic kind, their way with Taiwan, but that they may well be approaching the point, perhaps even in the course of this year, when the weather improves, to undertake the physical conquest of the island of Taiwan. Did I understand that correctly? Is that your current prognosis?
Yeah, I think any time in this decade, the potential is there. I tend to believe that they're going to continue to try to achieve their goals without using military force. I think that's what they really, really prefer, like they did at Scarborough Shoal in 2012. And like they did when they built those islands from 2012 to 2015 in the South China Sea, they were able to do things without having to kill anybody by using their pressure. But, you know, with the economic cooling off that they've had, based primarily on what this administration has done in terms of the economic confrontation and the phase one trade deal and all of that, and now with this virus and other things that are happening, the luster of the China juggernaut is coming off. And as that comes off, and the inevitability of being able to acquire Taiwan and acquire the Senkaku Islands and to acquire these other disputed areas in the South China Sea inside the Nine Dash Line, if those non-kinetic measures are proving to be ineffective, then the military is going to say, hey, we're ready to go and we have the capability. And we've designed ourselves specifically to, you know, counter-intervention or anti-access area denial, the U.S. military, so we can keep them at arm's length while we can conduct an invasion. And that's why they're building things like these Type 075 helicopter carrier dock landing ships. They're going to be able to launch helicopters from amphibious warships. They're building amphibious capabilities. They have the strategic rocket force. They've got a joint logistics force that they're actually testing out right now in this coronavirus episode. They're moving around logistics equipment all over China. This is, while it's bad and it's terrible that these people are dying, the military, the PLA, is using this as a lesson for how to transport things around their country and get it to the warfighting front.
So sea lift and airlift, as well as amphibious capabilities and missile and rocket forces, anti-aircraft capabilities that would extend over the island, all of these things are now in place or coming fully into place, Jim Fennell. And what I guess I hear you saying is that we must enhance our deterrence of any Chinese effort to take the island by force. What specifically, Jim, would you be recommending to, say, President Trump and his senior subordinates at this moment be done?
I think this is the stage right now where, given all that's going on and the pressure that's on China, that we need to add another log into the fire, if you will, and start having U.S. military forces go to Taiwan, exercise with the Taiwans. And I know that sounds crazy, and I know that the China Hands community would say that that's unwise and it would destabilize and cause China to lash out. But I think with everything that's going on with China, with their slowing economy and this virus and the world's of public opinion of them, they can't afford to take on an invasion of Taiwan right now. And so the fact that China has said we can't pull our ships into Hong Kong anymore. They've forbidden us to go there based on the events with in this preceding few months. So why should we sit here and worry about pulling ships into Taiwan? Let's do it. Let's ask our friends in Taiwan. I think they're quite receptive right now compared to before the elections in January. And let's start sending a signal to Beijing that if you really want to roll the dice, it's going to cost you much, much more than you ever calculated over the last 20 years. I would just say that, then we have to arm ourselves up and build up. And I know the administration's working on that, and we have to continue that
as aggressively as we can across a broad front, I think. Jim Fennell, thank you again for your extraordinary service to our country, both that you rendered in uniform over 3 decades, as well as that you are continuing to provide, notably through the wonderful Red Storm Rising Google group that you mastermind, and also, of course, as a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China. We appreciate you greatly, sir, as well as these visits with you from time to time. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, Benjamin Weingarten will give us a sneak preview of his new book about Ilhan Omar and talk about Iran and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we have in the house virtually one of the smartest relatively young men I know in the policy arena. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He has been, among other things, the founder and CEO of ChangeUp Media, LLC. He's also a senior contributor at The Federalist, a senior fellow at the London Center for Policy Research, and a fellow at the Claremont Institute, a man of many parts, and a very active contributor to the public policy debate on subjects near and dear to our hearts here at Secure Freedom Radio. It's always terrific to have him with us. Ben, thanks for joining us. Welcome back. And congratulations on the imminent publication of your new book. Give us the title and how people might find out more about it shortly.
Well, Frank, thanks so much for the opportunity to talk about it. And this might be the first time that I'm revealing the title publicly, so it's a real treat to do so. The title is American Ingrate, Ilhan Omar and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party. And really what this book does is uses Ilhan Omar, her unexplored background, her unchallenged beliefs, as a window, a vehicle into what is transpiring in the Democratic Party, which, as I argue, has been taken over by its squad, and in particular in Ilhan Omar, the Progressive Islamist instantiation of the squad's beliefs. The book also delves into Ilhan Omar's collusion with enemies, both foreign and domestic, applying the Mueller mandate to her based upon open source reporting, and makes a clear and cut case, I think, of very serious threats to national security posed by Ilhan Omar sitting on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And lastly, it also delves into the corruption and almost certain criminality associated with her personal dealings as well. So I think this is going to be a bombshell book. And in particular, as the Bernie Sanders and Warren wing rises, is a clarion call. And readers will be able to find out the minute it's released at bit.ly/BHW News. So bit.ly/BHW News.
How exciting. We look forward to having you back early in the publication phase. I know we're in the pre-publication phase, pre-Amazon purchase availability phase for that matter, but I know it's all imminent. And check out that URL for up-to-the-minute information about Ben Weingarten's new book, American Ingrate. Ben, let me ask you about something we've been talking about with other guests in the course of the program. You follow fairly closely the public pronouncements of individuals like Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Attorney General William Barr concerning China. And I'd be very interested in your take on Mike Pompeo's most recent speech and one that the Attorney General gave not so long ago as well on this very important subject.
Yeah, both of these speeches were essential. Secretary of State Pompeo's to the National Governors Association, where he spoke quite frankly about the efforts of the Chinese Communist Party to leverage economic ties with U.S. businesses and U.S. officials as well. And I think one of the big news breaking items that Pompeo broke dealt with the fact that one Chinese think tank had identified all of our governors and ranked them in terms of essentially pliability, whether or not they take a hostile position towards the Chinese government or one that is a bit more open and inviting. And Pompeo, speaking also with the perspective of someone who ran the CIA, gave, I think, amazing insight into the whole of government Chinese strategy to use our open society against us. And Attorney General Barr, on the other hand, gave a speech from the sort of Department of Justice, FBI perspective, dealing with the DOJ's China initiative, which we've seen the fruits of in any number of recent indictments and prosecutions that have come down of malign Chinese actors, whether in the realms of economic espionage or other subterfuge aimed at either stealing our crown jewels in technology or otherwise, sabotage, or otherwise seeking to infiltrate and undermine our country.
Mike Pompeo and Attorney General Barr, of course, have also had company from the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, and the President's weighed in on occasion as well about what China's up to. This is one of, I think, the most important contributions the Trump administration is making in the foreign policy arena, both to audiences here at home and elsewhere, as you say, Ben Weingarten, that they're clear-eyed about the threat China poses and warning, whether it's governors or businessmen or the public at large, about this very serious and growing danger. It's urgently needed and certainly welcomed by those of us on the Committee for the Present Danger, China. Let me ask you, Ben, about another topic that you've also been writing about lately, and I know given a lot of thought to, particularly against the backdrop of what didn't happen in the course of the last Democratic debate before tomorrow's voting in the New Hampshire primary. In New Hampshire, the Democratic candidates had a hard time agreeing to the proposition that the elimination of Qasem Soleimani was a good thing. This sort of fits into the larger problem with Democratic politicians and Iran. Walk us through both that debate and this particular problem personified by Barack Obama's right-hand man, Ben Rhodes, and some of the things he's said at the time of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and more recently.
Yeah, I think what we saw on that debate stage, which included practically all of the major candidates, maybe with the exception of Mayor Mike Bloomberg, so it'll be interesting to hear if he weighs in on this, was there was a question posed about whether essentially, the strike on Qasem Soleimani was an unalloyed good for the U.S. And that's even really being charitable to those asking the question and those responding to it. Basically, none of the Democratic candidates on stage would say that taking out Soleimani was the right thing to do. Certainly, they wouldn't say it unequivocally. And that sort of proves that on the left, we're living in Ben Rhodes' world. It actually folds in quite well with one of my arguments in the forthcoming book, American Ingrate, as well, about the state of the Democratic Party. And as I've argued, and against Ben Rhodes' argument specifically, where he was sort of hysterical about the strike on Soleimani, first of all, as Lee Smith argued, Soleimani was one of the primary people who was at the deal table when the JCPOA was inked in the first place, because sanctions were removed from his head as a result of that deal. The strike on Soleimani was both symbolically and substantively significant, and it's worth talking about the substance for a second, given that this was the man who was the architect of Iran's malign efforts globally. He spearheaded the strategy to build a Shia crescent and was going about very adroitly executing it throughout the Middle East. Taking out Soleimani really was taking out an irreplaceable figure in that Khomeinist regime's ultimate grand strategy. And in my view, it has really thrown them into chaos in many respects. And there is not a real heir apparent, even though he has been replaced atop the Quds force of the IRGC. So what I would suggest is that it was absolutely an unalloyed good for the U.S. on the substantive side. And on the symbolic side, it showed that America was no longer going to take attacks and provocations against our life and limb, and that we'll actually respond with, in effect, overwhelming force in response to it, given how critical Soleimani was to the Iranian regime. So it was a masterstroke to do it. It showed a level of resolve and seriousness that the Iranians, I do not believe, expected. And it also sent a signal to other world powers, adversarial world powers, including the North Koreans, for example, that America is just not going to tolerate that kind of behavior anymore. And I think it's really thrown the Iranian regime into even further chaos on top of the problems it's already dealing with.
Let me ask you about one other thing quickly. Ben Rhodes had a very low regard for the press and made no bones about the fact that he manipulated them. That manipulation seems to be continuing in the present environment, is it not?
Yeah, Frank, I think your read is absolutely correct. And there's a question of whether this is sort of the press being willfully blind or the fact that the press is actually on the road side of these issues. And obviously they have political reasons for wanting to spin everything with Iran as, well, the Trump administration is about to get us embroiled in a massive conflict because they want to see President Trump lose. Sadly, that also has the press oftentimes sounding like mouthpieces of the Khomeinist regime. And that's a disaster for the American people. It only further discredits a press that had already sort of proven itself to be the Democrat communications arm. And it's bad for the morale of the country as well. So it really does a disservice all the way around. But the good thing is Americans can see the truth with their eyes. And the truth is that the Khomeinist regime really is being strangled to an unprecedented degree. And that foretells positive things in the long run for the U.S., even if in the short run, a wounded bear can potentially be quite dangerous.
And importantly, positive things for the Iranian people as well. Thank you so much, Ben Weingarten, for your time and your very provocative and, I think, thoughtful comments on all of these questions. Again, we look forward to the publication of American Ingrate and the chance to visit with you at length about that. I know you'll keep up the good work at the Federalist and Claremont Institute and the London Center, and hope you'll return to us soon as well. And that the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.